Baker, Houston, Texas. Anna makes two New Year's resolutions. She's going to spend more time at home with Baker and Floyd, and she's going to become friends with at least one of the other mothers at Floyd's Montessori school, the children's cottage. She hands Baker a page from her prescription pad, Dr. Anna Schaefer, MD, with the two goals written down. 1. More time at home. 2. Friends. Baker finds he has follow-up questions. Does more time at home mean that she'll have sex with him on days other than his birthday and their anniversary? Does making friends mean that some of the at-home time will be spent on girls' night out or in long phone conversations listening to Delia, mother of Sophie, air her grievances against Mandy, mother of Aiden? Baker folds the paper in half, kisses it, and puts it in his jeans pocket. It's appropriate that Anna wrote her resolutions on the prescription pad because their relationship is sick and these two actions will hopefully heal it.
Good for you, he says. What should we do today?
A look of panic crosses Anna's face. She's a beautiful woman. Her olive skin is flawless. She has impenetrable brown eyes and long dark hair. She exudes serenity and, beyond that, competence. She's a cardiothoracic surgeon at Memorial Hermann and a natural-born perfectionist, at least when it comes to her professional life. It's only her personal life that she has trouble navigating. Today, she says. She checks her phone. I have to go to the hospital.
It's New Year's Day, Baker says.
It's Tuesday, she says. I have rounds. But, Baker says, waving the page from her prescription pad in the air, am I supposed to tell Mr. Kavetsky, who just had a triple bypass, that I can't check on him because I have to, what, do a gouache project with my husband and four-year-old? Watch Despicable Me 3 yet again?
You haven't even seen it once, Baker says.
His voice is defiant, verging on bratty. He sounds like a four-year-old. But come on. Dr. Anna Schaefer, representing herself as someone who is routinely subjected to children's movies, is downright unfair. Anna never watches movies with Floyd. She hasn't seen Despicable Me 3, or 1 and 2 for that matter. On the rare occasion that Anna does sit down with Baker and Floyd to watch a movie, she falls asleep in the comfy womb of the leather gel recliner, leaving Baker to answer Floyd's rapid-fire questions about the intricacies of character and plot. Floyd, like his mother, has a finely tuned intellect, but it's as if after physically giving birth to Floyd, after donating the genius half of his DNA, Anna decided her job was done. First, she turned the care and feeding of Floyd over to a baby nurse for the staggering fee of $350 a day. And then, when Anna was done breastfeeding, she nearly always pumped milk, she was a fiend about it, in fact, insisting that it was much more efficient than latching Floyd onto her actual body when he was going to switch to the bottle eventually anyway, they hired an El Salvadorian nanny named Maria Jose. Maria Jose and Anna didn't see eye to eye. Maria Jose held Floyd all day long, so that in the evenings, when Anna came home from the hospital, Floyd was set down and he would cry, and so Maria Jose was dismissed. Then Anna hired Svana from Iceland, who drew Floyd a bath that was too hot and scalded him the color of a lobster, necessitating a trip to urgent care. Goodbye, Svana. At that point, Baker was in the process of looking for a job in private equity, but he kept getting to final interviews and not getting hired. He suspected that Houston firms tended to hire Texas boys, especially those who had played high school football. And since Anna's career provided plenty of money, Baker thought, why didn't he stay home and care for Floyd? He could day trade while Floyd napped. Day trading encapsulated everything he loved about his field. It was a game, a gamble, a risk, a thrill. And he was good at it.
He was also good at parenting. The love and joy and wonder he felt when he looked at tiny baby Floyd, a person, another person that he had helped create, was nearly overwhelming. Why would he pay someone else to care for their child when he could do it himself? Anna had put up the predictable arguments. Staying home with Floyd wouldn't provide Baker with any intellectual stimulation. "You'll be bored stiff," she said. He would be like the unfulfilled housewives of the 1950s. He would choose something inappropriate to fill his time, internet porn or marijuana, or an affair with one of the other mothers he met at the playground. He would get so far behind in his career that he would never catch up. What would Baker do when Floyd was 18 and headed to college? Even 3 years hence, when Floyd went to preschool, too much time would have passed for Baker to seamlessly re-enter the world of high finance. He would become depressed, smoke more weed, get addicted to pills. Baker had assured Anna at the time that she was being melodramatic. But now, Floyd is 4 years old, and while he is a very bright, curious, and well-adjusted kid, it's true that Baker's decision to stay home has created issues. First of all, Anna has grown so comfortable with their new roles that she has, essentially, checked out of family life altogether. Secondly, whereas Baker has not become addicted to internet porn, nor had an affair, he does smoke a fair amount of dope, and he has developed very close friendships with a group of the other mothers, all of whom have sons and daughters at the children's cottage. His clique includes Wendy, Becky, Debbie, and Ellen. They are all single mothers, three divorced and one single by choice, which is how they became friends in the first place. They have more or less adopted Baker as their school husband. He covers their kids when they have work emergencies. He fixes things around their houses and gives them free investment advice. He suspects that the other mothers, the married mothers, are critical of the relationship between Baker and his school wives, but it wasn't until the holiday sing that he realized just how jealous and vile women could be. One of them cornered Anna in the bathroom and told her she was very evolved for letting Baker have a harem. Anna had not been amused. Baker assured her the friendships were just that and not one thing more. He informed Anna that if she wanted to put an end to the vicious gossip, she should show her face around school more often. She should make some friends of her own, which was how they arrived at resolution number two. "Why can't someone else cover your rounds?" Baker asks now. "Why can't Louisa do it?" Louisa is another surgeon in the practice, Anna's closest friend. It feels like Anna is forever going in to cover Louisa's patients. Surely Anna is due a return favor. "Louisa is busy," Anna snaps. "We're all busy." "I won't make you do gouache," Baker says. It's a very cool painting technique that Wendy taught him. She makes her own greeting cards and wrapping paper. "Or watch Despicable Me 3. I thought we could go to the park. It's beautiful out." "I'm sure Floyd will love it," Anna says. She grabs her bag and smiles. Smiles are what pass for kisses these days. "I'll be home by 6. We can get pizza." She says this, apparently not recalling that Baker has bought a roast he'd planned to serve with his boursin potatoes and sautéed asparagus. Anna isn't impressed by Baker's efforts in the kitchen. In her world, each dawning day is merely another chance to eat pizza. "Okay," Baker says. He watches Anna's back disappear through the door, and at that moment, he knows he has no choice. He has to ask for a divorce. Divorce, he thinks as he waits at the bottom of the big slide for Floyd. It's such a dark, ugly, complicated word. Floyd comes whooshing down, his bangs flying. He's such a good kid, so cute and perfect in his boyness. "That was my 10th time down," Floyd says. "Let's go to the swings." Always 10 times down the slide, no more, no less, and slide always precedes swings, where Baker is allowed to push Floyd 7 times, then Floyd takes over under the power of his own pumping legs. Baker senses some OCD tendencies in the rules Floyd sticks to at the park, although the jungle gym is a free-for-all and Floyd is very sociable and can make friends with other children in an instant, as he does today. When he's finished on the swings, he joins a game of tag, leaving Baker to lie back in the grass and let the mellow January sunshine warm his face. Divorce. Divorce Anna. Will she even notice? She'll move out and rent one of the condos across the street from the hospital. She'll have no problem paying for the house and for Baker and Floyd's living expenses. Baker has a tidy sum in the bank as well. His luck this past year playing the market has been tremendous. All will be well. Baker's only concern is that Anna will never see Floyd if they don't live in the same house. And yet, isn't that concern the exact reason why Baker should get out? What kind of mother doesn't love her own child? That may be too harsh. Certainly, Anna loves Floyd. But does she like him? Does she enjoy one single thing about being a parent? Baker sits up on his elbows and watches Floyd, running and laughing, right in the thick of it with a bunch of kids he just met. He's so happy and carefree. Can Baker really be considering putting the kid through the emotional trauma of a divorce? Anna's parents are divorced. Her father has been divorced twice. And so that is her idea of normal. But Baker's parents have been happily married for 35 years. Baker knows that Irene and Russ will see his divorce as a failure. He will see it as a failure. It's a new year, Baker thinks. And Anna did make the resolutions, which is a promising start. He'll give it more time, he decides. Maybe she'll surprise him. Anna doesn't make it home by 6, although she does call. I'm going to be another hour, she says. Just order the pizza without me. Does she ever get tired of disappointing people? Baker wonders. Will do, he says. He won't order pizza, but neither will he go to the trouble of making the roast. Floyd has asked for pancakes for dinner, and pancakes he will get. Baker makes bacon and squeezes some fresh juice. Why not? Would you mind staying awake until I get home? Anna asks. She sounds almost nervous, and Baker gets a flutter of excitement in his stomach. Absolutely, he says. That simple question changes the whole tenor of the evening. Anna wants him to stay awake. She wants to spend time with him. She wants to connect, maybe. He'll give her a massage. He'll draw her a bath. He'll wash her hair. He'll do anything she wants. He loves her so much. At times, it's like loving a shadow or a hologram. But not tonight. Baker makes big, fluffy buttermilk pancakes and crispy bacon, and he gives Floyd 2 cups of juice, even though that's a lot of sugar before bed. Baker cleans the kitchen, does the dishes, sends Floyd down the hall to brush his teeth. He helps Floyd get into his pajamas, then reads him The Dirty Cowboy, even though it's long. Floyd falls asleep on page 6 as he always does, and Baker eases himself off the bed, turns on the nightlight, and slips out of the room. This is the time of night that he usually takes a few hits off his bong, but he won't tonight. He needs to stay awake. He cracks open a beer, gets himself a dish of Ben and Jerry's red velvet cake ice cream, which Ellen, his single-by-choice mom friend, turned him onto. She eats like a long-haul trucker, in her own words. And he switches on the TV to get a recap of the bowl games. He's just drifting off when he hears Anna coming through the door, and he sits bolt upright. He's awake. Hey, babe, he says. I'm in here. He hears Anna in the kitchen, rummaging through the fridge,
opening the cabinets. He hears a cork being pulled from wine. A few seconds later, Anna comes into the den. She lets her hair free of her elastic, takes a sip of wine, and regards him with an expression he can't read. Interest? Curiosity? What does she see when she looks at him, he wonders? Well, he's slouched on the sofa with an open beer and half a bowl of melted ice cream on the table next to him, so she can hardly view him as a sexy world conqueror. He sits up straight, moves over, pats the sofa next to him. He is soft with forgiveness. It's as easy for him to fall into his chubby hubby stoner dad role as it is for Anna to default to her super busy achieving spouse. He's guilty of smoking a joint and falling asleep on the sofa most nights. He's as much to blame for their disconnect as she is. She reaches for the remote and shuts off the TV. In the 6 years of their marriage, 8 years together, Baker has never known Anna to watch a single minute of television. How was work? Baker asks.
I'm leaving you, Anna says.
What?
I'm in love with someone else, Anna says. And it's beyond my control, so I'm not going to bother apologizing for it.
Oh, Baker says. Okay.
He looks at his wife. With her hair down and loose, she is at her most beautiful, which he feels is unfair given the circumstances. But then, too, Baker experiences a strange sense of inevitability. He knew this was coming, didn't he? Earlier today, when he thought about divorce, when he had all but decided on it, in fact, it was because he knew this was coming. Anna doesn't love him. She loves someone else. But who? Who is it?
Who? Baker says. Who is it?
Louisa, Anna says. I'm in love with Louisa.
She's in love with Louisa. Anna doesn't bother giving him time to process, to react, to emote.
No.
She takes her wine and leaves the room. Baker sinks back into the Baker-shaped and sized divot on the couch. His phone rings. It's his mother.
His mother?
No. He can't possibly speak to his mother right now. Briefly, he wonders if Anna called his parents to inform them she was leaving him, then decides the answer is no. Anna and his mother don't have a relationship. And Russ once naively referred to Anna as a smart cookie, and Anna hasn't spoken to him since. The house phone rings, and Baker wonders who on earth would be calling the house phone at 10 o'clock on New Year's night. The ringing stops. Anna calls down the hall.
Bake, it's your mom.
This is not happening, Baker thinks. Now he has to get on the phone and make at least 60 seconds of pleasant conversation without letting his mother know that his life is dissolving like an aspirin in acid. His wife is in love with her esteemed colleague, Louisa.
Hey, Mom, Baker says, picking up the phone in the kitchen.
He hears Anna hang up.
Happy New Year.
Baker, Irene says.
She's crying. So obviously Anna did tell her.
Mom, listen.
Baker scrambles for a way to talk Irene off the ledge. She was born and raised in Iowa. She's the editor of Heartland Home and Style. Do they even have lesbians in the Heartland? Baker doesn't mean to be a wise guy. He obviously knows the answer is yes, and Irene and Russ live in Iowa City, which is pretty much the People's Republic of Iowa. But even so, he worries this is really going to upset her, confuse her. She's going to ask why Anna turned into a lesbian. She's going to ask if it's Baker's fault.
Baker, Irene says, there was an accident. Your father is dead.
Part 2. Little Cinnamon. Irene.
She wrote down everything Marilyn Monroe told her. There was a helicopter crash. Russ and a local woman and the pilot left from a private helipad at 7 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday, January 1st. There had been a thunderstorm. The helicopter was struck and it went down somewhere between Virgin Gorda and Anegada. Anegada had been the apparent destination, Marilyn said. The helicopter wreckage had been recovered, as well as the three bodies. Mr. Steele's property manager traveled to the BVIs to identify the body, Marilyn said. And Mr. Croft has arranged for cremation. Wait, Irene said. What? She knew that Russ wanted to be cremated. It's what they both want. But does this mean... Am I not going to see him again, then, before? I'm sorry, Mrs. Steele, Marilyn said. You're going to have to trust Mr. Croft's judgment on this. The body needed to be identified as soon as possible, so Mr. Croft requested that Mr. Steele's property manager do it. Time was of the essence. A decision had to be made. I don't understand, Irene said. Shouldn't I have been the one to make the decision? I'm his wife. Who is this so-called property manager? What does that even mean? I don't understand. I know this is coming as a shock, Marilyn said. Beyond a shock. Again, you'll just have to trust that Mr. Croft took the appropriate measures. Trust Todd Croft? He was a man Irene had met briefly only once. A man who had controlled their lives for 13 years. And it wasn't even Todd himself telling Irene that Russ had died in a helicopter crash between Virgin Gorda and someplace else, a place Irene had never heard of, but rather his secretary, Marilyn Monroe. It was like a joke, a prank, a bad dream. Irene had gone so far as to pinch the soft skin on the underside of her wrist, hard, to make sure she was awake and cogent, that Ryan, their handsome server, hadn't slipped something into the cake bread Chardonnay. Marilyn was telling Irene that some property manager had ID'd the body and that Todd Croft had given the okay to cremate the body. Time was of the essence, and Irene would never see her husband again. Why was Russ in the Virgin Islands? Irene asked. He never once mentioned the Virgin Islands. Was he there for work? He had concerns there, Marilyn said. He owned a home there. A home? Irene said. My husband did not own a home in the Virgin Islands. I would obviously know if he owned a home. I'm his wife. I'm very sorry, Marilyn had said. She paused. Mr. Steele owns a villa on St. John. A villa? Yes, Marilyn said. If you have a pen and paper, I can give you the specifics. Pen and paper? Irene said. I'm flying down there. That's not advisable, Marilyn said. You can't stop me, Irene said. Russ was my husband. I've lost my husband. Does this secretary, Marilyn Monroe, understand? Irene briefly, fancifully, thinks about the husbands of the real Marilyn Monroe. Arthur Miller, Joe DiMaggio, someone else. I'm going down there to see about this so-called home, because frankly, this all sounds suspicious. Are you sure we're talking about Russell Steele of Iowa City, Iowa? Originally from... Where was Russ born? She can't remember. Are you sure? Mrs. Steele, Marilyn said. Her tone of voice made it sound like Irene was being unreasonable. There's a woman who will meet you at the ferry if you insist on making the trip. Her name is Paulette Vickers. Her number is 340-555-6121. She'll take you to Mr. Steele's villa. Irene's head was spinning. She had drunk too much of the cake bread Chardonnay. Dinner at the Pullman with Lydia, Brandon the barista at Prairie Lights, all of that now seemed to belong to a different life. I'm very sorry, Irene, Marilyn Monroe said, more gently now, and then she hung up. Cash arrives at noon the next day. Irene wakes up sprawled across the fainting couch in her clothes when Winnie licks her face. She languishes in the warm, wet love of her son's dog before she comes to full consciousness. Slowly, she opens her eyes, sees Cash's expression, and she remembers. Russ is dead. Helicopter crash. West Indian woman, a local, dead, and the pilot also dead. Villa. On a scrap of paper on the coffee table is the phone number of someone named Paulette. Also on the paper is Irene's flight information. Cash has always been a free spirit, but he does a remarkably good job of taking charge. First, he sits next to Irene on the purple velvet fainting couch and holds both her hands in his. He's expecting her to cry. She keeps expecting herself to cry, to gush like a dam breaking. Her husband of 35 years is dead, but nothing comes. She doesn't believe it. It makes no sense. There's been a mistake. Russ is in the Virgin Islands and went on a helicopter ride to an island no one has ever heard of with a local woman? And what did Marilyn Monroe say about a villa? What is a villa exactly? Irene pictures a vacation home, a tropical vacation home. Marilyn had called it Mr. Steele's home, which makes no sense. Russ's home is here on Church Street. He and Irene talked about buying some place up in Door County once Millie passed so that they could have the boys and their families come visit. Irene had pictured water skiing, trout fishing, big family dinners around a harvest table, lighting sparklers out on the porch while they listened to the loons. She envisioned a silvered, aging version of her and Russ, side by side in rocking chairs. But that image implodes like a star. Millie, Irene says. They need to tell Millie. Not yet, Cash says. First, we're going to worry about you. He looks at the paper on the coffee table. These are your flights? You booked these? Irene nods. She booked the flight last night, although it now seems like a dream. Making plane reservations to St. Thomas, Irene discovered she can't fly to St. John because St. John has no airport. Private helipads, yes, but no commercial airport. She has to take a ferry from St. Thomas. Has no basis in Irene's reality. And yet, she did it. She flies Chicago to Atlanta, and then Atlanta to St. Thomas on Delta. She has booked herself coming back a week later, and that seems even more surreal. Who would Irene be after a week in St. John collecting her husband's remains? Because she certainly can't do it and stay the same person she is now. I booked them, she says. I have to be in Chicago tomorrow by 9. I'll drive, Cash says. I'm going to book myself on the flight as well. Myself and Winnie. And I'll tell Baker to meet us in Atlanta. With Floyd? Irene asks. No, Floyd has school. He's staying home with Anna. It'll be just you, me, and Baker. And Winnie. Irene nods. There are so many things to think about, but none come to mind. This woman, Paulette, is supposed to pick us up. Would you call her and let her know we're coming? I will, Cash says. I'm going to bring you ice water and aspirin. I'm going to make coffee. Can you handle toast?
I cannot handle toast, Irene says.
She takes a deep breath and looks around the impeccably furnished amethyst parlor. How many hours did she slave over this room, this house? For the past 6 years, she has been married to this house. Russ came second. He used to joke about it. When she was in a good mood, she told him she was feathering their love nest. When she was in a bad mood, she told him he was never home anyway, so what did it matter if she were preoccupied?
Only now does she realize how little she actually paid attention to him, to the particulars of his work, to where he was and what he did. When she talked to him on Monday afternoon, what had he said? He had a dinner meeting with clients. He wasn't sure if he would be able to stay up until midnight. He loved her. Had he been lying? Russ's villa. The Virgin Islands. A local woman. Yes, he'd been lying. When Cash comes back in with Irene's coffee, she says, I haven't told anyone except you and Baker. Good, Cash says. I haven't told my friends. I haven't told work. I haven't told Millie. What am I going to tell Millie? Let's do this, Cash says. I'll call the magazine and tell them there's been a family emergency and that you'll be out the next week or so. Irene nods. Work is the least of her worries because, of course, she has just been demoted. The magazine will be fine without her. She doesn't care about the magazine. She doesn't care about anything except this. This. Russ. He's gone. We can't tell Millie, Cash says. We can't not tell Millie, Irene says. Let's tell her together when we get back, Cash says. We can't tell her and then leave. That's right, Irene says. We can't tell her and then leave. Call her tonight, as usual, Cash says. Tell her we're taking a surprise vacation. A surprise vacation, Irene thinks. It's a blur, all a blur, until the plane lands in St. Thomas and the other passengers erupt in applause. Irene peers out the window. St. Thomas has verdant hills, green and lush, dotted with brightly colored buildings, yellow and pink, the color of sand, the color of shells. The water is, well, it's the brilliant turquoise you see in advertisements. Yes, St. Thomas is supposed to be a place that makes you clap and cheer. It's so pretty, Irene says.
Anna and I honeymooned on Anguilla, Baker says. It looked like this, only flatter.
That's right, you did, Irene says. She remembers being nonplussed when Baker and Anna chose Anguilla. Irene and Russ had offered the honeymoon as a wedding present, anywhere they wanted to go, anywhere in the world, and they had chosen Anguilla. It had seemed so unimaginative to Irene. But Baker had said that Anna wanted to stay close to home. She had wanted sunshine, massages, a constant flow of alcohol. She didn't want to tour anything. Irene, if she had her druthers, would vacation in Europe. France, Switzerland, England, places with history, places with culture. And so that was what she and Russ had done. A week in London, a week in the Cotswolds, a week in Provence, in Paris, in San Moritz. Or they went to Colorado and skied. Irene harbors a natural prejudice against the Caribbean. Why is that? She thinks back on a trip to Jamaica when the boys were young, 8 and 10, maybe 9 and 7. This was before they had money, so they had booked a mediocre hotel near the airport. It had rained all week. They had barely left their rooms, but Russ had finally given the boys money to go to the arcade in the hotel lobby. Baker and Cash were down there for a couple of hours. Irene had napped, and then she had woken up, alarmed to discover they still weren't back. Russ had gone down to check on them and had come rushing up, frantic. The kids were gone. Irene can still recall the sheer panic she felt then. It had been like falling into a hole with no bottom. They had alerted hotel security, who had directed them to a shanty town right across the street from the hotel. Sometimes women infiltrated the lobby and convinced hotel guests to shop for souvenirs. The town was a mishmash of shacks with corrugated tin roofs. It was noisy in the rain.
There were women cooking and men playing cards and children and chickens running around, plenty of children. So it wasn't sinister by any means, but it had seemed so to Irene, a rabbit warren of foreignness that had swallowed her sons. She lashed out at the men, screaming, "Where are my children, my sons?" Her voice was accusatory, when really the only person Irene could blame was herself. She had been napping, and now her boys were gone. They had turned up, of course, almost immediately. They were listening to a gentleman with long, graying dreadlocks playing the guitar in one of the shacks. Irene had grabbed Baker so fiercely, she'd nearly wrenched his arm out of its socket. That had been it for Irene in the Caribbean. She had smiled politely whenever anyone said they were headed to Barbados or Aruba or the Dominican Republic, and she probably said, "I'm sure it will be wonderful." But in her head, she had been thinking, "Better you than me." And now, here she is. They have to descend a set of stairs onto the tarmac, then walk into the terminal. The air is warm, humid, sweet-smelling. Irene is wearing a white short-sleeved blouse and a pair of khaki capri pants, sandals, sunglasses. She knows what she looks like to everyone else. She looks like a woman taking a vacation. Airs. Helicopter crash off Virgin Gorda. 3 dead. Rosie, the invisible man, the pilot, whose name was Stephen Thompson. Ayers doesn't know if he was white or West Indian. "They think the helicopter got hit by lightning," Mick says. "Did you hear the storm this morning?" Ayers had been woken up by the thunder, but then she'd fallen right back to sleep. "What do I do?" she asks Mick. "Where do I go?" He holds his arms out to offer her a hug, and she accepts. Out the front door, she sees Gordon sitting patiently in the passenger seat of Mick's blue Jeep. No Bridget, thank God. Although what does Bridget matter anymore? Ayers thought Mick dumping her for Bridget equaled heartbreak. But now Ayers understands a new definition of heartbreak. Rosie is dead. "I have to go to Huck's," Ayers says. "I'll drive you," Mick says. "Let's go." Huck lives up Jacob's Ladder, a series of switchbacks so steep that Ayers' head lolls back and she feels like she might swallow her tongue. At the last turn before Huck's duplex, the cars are lined up. 2 local police cars, pickup trucks, a Jeep that belongs to Huck's first mate, Adam, a car from U.S. Customs and Border Control. Walking down the street are the West Indian women, many of them friends of Leanne's, Ayers knows, some of them carrying covered dishes, some carrying flowers, one holding a Bible over her head. It's as busy as downtown during Carnival. One thing about a close-knit community like St. John, no one endures a tragedy alone. Ayers experienced the celebration of Leanne Power's life 5 years earlier. Ayers hadn't realized until then that dying could be beautiful and filled with love. Leanne had been 60 years old when she died, a newly retired nurse practitioner and a grandmother. She had congestive heart failure, so her death hadn't been a great surprise. Rosie, Maya, and Huck had all had time to say goodbye. Rosie's death is something else entirely, but the support and prayers will be great, maybe greater. Many, if not all of these women, have watched Rosie grow up. A handful probably cared for Rosie while Leanne worked nights and weekends up at the Myra Keating Smith Health Center and over at Schneider Hospital on St. Thomas, until Captain Huck swept Leanne off her feet and married her. Mick hits the brakes before ascending the final hill, and Ayers sees the uncertainty on his face. Do they belong here? They're locals, but they aren't native islanders. Neither of them has family here, or roots. They merely have jobs. Mick has managed the beach bar for 11 years. Ayers has waited tables at Latapa for 9 years and been a crew member on Treasure Island for 7. She has never had anyone close to her die. What's the protocol? If Ayers were to list anyone as a family member on this island, it would be Rosie. Would have been Rosie. And Maya and Huck. So yes, Ayers is going up to the house. If she doesn't go, what would Huck think?
Park up there, Ayers says, indicating a spot mid-hill. We can walk the rest of the way.
You go, Mick says. I'll wait here until you want to leave. Or, if you decide to stay for a while, text me and I'll come back for you later.
Ayers nods and rubs Gordon's bucket head. She has missed him, and when human words and emotions fail, animals still provide comfort. She climbs out of the jeep. It's broiling in the sun, and Ayers' stomach roils with last night's tequila and that stupid cigarette. Her best friend is dead. Ayers stops. She's going to vomit or faint. Her vision splotches. One of the West Indian women, Deary, she has a beauty shop up behind the lumberyard building, takes Ayers' hand and all but pulls her up the hill.
Ayers.
She sees Huck hurrying off his porch, where a group of men, some white, some West Indian, some in uniform, some not, are gathered. A West Indian woman named Helen, she was Leanne's best friend, emerges from the house with a pot of coffee and starts filling cups.
Oh, Huck, Ayers whispers.
She stands with her arms hanging uselessly at her sides, tears streaming down her face as he gathers her up in a hug. He's a big bear of a man with a bushy, reddish-gray beard and the ropey, muscled forearms of a fisherman. He's missing half his left pinky thanks to a feisty barracuda. He's an island character, nearly an icon. Everyone knows Huck, but few love him like Ayers does, and like Rosie did. He was more a father to Rosie than Rosie's own father, and the same can probably be said for Ayers.
Is it true? She asks.
He lets her go.
It's true, he says.
His eyes shine.
Helicopter went down. They were headed over to Anegada for the day, I guess.
Ayers has questions. They means Rosie and the Invisible Man, but why did they take a helicopter and not a boat, like normal people? Too slow, she figures. Helicopter is faster and makes more of a statement. What happened? Who was this pilot, Stephen Thompson, and did he not check the weather report? Aren't there rules? The FAA and whatever? But those questions don't matter.
Maya?
Ayers asks.
She's at Joni's, Huck says. I talked to Joni's parents. They had planned to take the girls to Salt Pond and then down to hike Ram's Head in the late afternoon once it cooled down, then have dinner at Cafe Concordia. I told them to go ahead with their plans. Maya may end up hating me for it, but I want her to have today. I'll tell her when she gets home. I was hoping you would be here when I tell her. She likes you. What does she always say? You're like her mom, but...
But better, Ayers says, because I'm not her mom.
She's going to need you now, Huck says. She's going to need you a whole lot.
Okay,
Ayers says, but she can barely get the word out because she's crying too hard. It's fine, she thinks. She'll cry now. She can fall to absolute pieces now, but there's a 12-year-old girl depending on her to be strong, and damn it, Ayers isn't going to let her down. Cash. Cash treats his mother like she's made of bone china. She's not, he knows. She has kept a stiff upper lip thus far, and she looks pulled together. Her chestnut hair is in its usual fat braid with a swoop of bangs that dips toward her right eye. For Cash's entire life, his mother's hair has looked exactly the same.
They used to tease her about it, but now Cash finds it soothing. If Irene braided her hair, some essential part of her is intact. He can't imagine what must be going through her mind. It's bad enough that Russ is dead, but to die in such a dramatic, suspicious way, in a place none of them even knew he was, and then to find out that he has concerns and owns property here? It's also an unusual burden to be on such a somber mission in such an achingly beautiful place. It's bright, sunny, hot, the air is crystalline, the water is a surreal turquoise color. It's more beautiful than any water Cash has ever seen. The islands are green and mountainous, volcanic, he learned when he did a little research. There are enormous yachts anchored in the harbor, with people out drinking, barbecuing, playing reggae music. The ferry is abuzz with excited tourists talking about fish tacos at longboards and snorkeling at Maho Bay. Cash picks three seats on the far right side of the boat. He and Baker have barely spoken a word to each other since meeting up in Atlanta. Russ's death hasn't changed the fact that Baker is one of Cash's least favorite people on planet Earth. They take the seats on either side of their mother, buffering her. Winnie hangs her head over the lower railing, panting at the ocean. She's a mountain dog. This is all brand new to her. It only takes 20 minutes to reach St. John. Cash has read that it's a smaller, more rustic cousin of St. Thomas. There are no traffic lights, no chain stores, and only one small casino called the Parrot Club. 70% of the land on St. John is owned by the National Park Service. It's for hikers and snorkelers, birders and fishermen, people who love the outdoors. Cash likes the sound of the island. Or he would, under other circumstances. The woman who is meeting them is named Paulette Vickers. Cash spoke with her on the phone. She told him she was the property manager of Mr. Steele's villa. The phrase, property manager, triggered something Irene had told him. Are you the one who identified my father's body? Cash asked. That was my husband, Douglas, Paulette said. And your husband knew my father? Knew what he looked like? And my father was dead? And the man who was dead was actually my father, Russell Steele? Cash had paused. I know these questions sound strange. It's just that I'm in a state of suspended disbelief. Yes, yes, she understood, she said. Though how could she possibly? Paulette said that she took care of maintaining the villa in the summer months when Mr. Steele is away, and Paulette's husband, Douglas, did all the handyman work. When Cash asked how long his father had owned the villa, Paulette had been slow to answer. She said she had inherited the villa from another property manager 3 years earlier. She wasn't certain when Mr. Steele had bought the villa. She would have to check the files. All right, I'll wait, Cash had said, and Paulette had laughed. How are you related to Mr. Steele? Paulette asked. Marilyn from Mr. Croft's office said only that a family member would be calling. I'm his son, Cash said. His younger son. My brother will be coming as well, and my mother, Irene. Mr. Steele's widow. This had elicited a long pause from Paulette. I see, she said. Is there a problem? Cash asked. He meant, aside from the obvious problem that his father was dead under mysterious circumstances. Not at all, Paulette said. I didn't realize Mr. Steele had sons, but then again, he was a very private person. He liked to keep a low profile, to be invisible, he used to say. The villa, as you'll see, has everything. A pool and a hot tub, a shuffleboard court and a billiards table, multiple decks and outdoor living spaces, 9 bedrooms, 7 of them en suite, and of course a private beach. There was no reason for him to leave the property, and he rarely did. Cash's head was spinning. 9 bedrooms? A shuffleboard court? A private beach? It just wasn't possible. Cash had thanked Paulette,
given her the details of their travel, and hung up. Cash and Baker help their mother off the ferry while Winnie goes nuts, pulling on the leash, intrigued by so many new smells. Cash sees a West Indian woman in a purple dress waving at him. Is that Paulette Vickers? How would she have recognized him? He wonders if Paulette were friends with Russ, if maybe Russ had showed Paulette pictures of his family at home. But then Cash remembers that he told Paulette he was bringing his golden retriever. He strides up to her and offers his hand. Paulette, I'm Cash Steele. Can we get into your car and away from here with minimum fanfare? It has only just occurred to Cash that there might be some attendant celebrity to being the family of the man who died in the helicopter crash on New Year's Day. Yes, of course, Paulette says. She waits, smile plastered to her face, while Irene and Baker approach, and then she offers Irene her hand. Irene stares. You knew my husband? Irene asks. You knew Russ? Mom, let's get to the car, Cash says. Baker smooths things over by taking Paulette's outstretched hand and saying, Very nice to meet you. Thank you for coming to get us. What a beautiful island. Cash gives Baker a hard stare. It is a beautiful island, but it hardly seems appropriate to say so. Paulette, although she must realize the three of them are numb with shock and grief, prattles on about the sights as though they are run-of-the-mill tourists. The town is called Cruise Bay. It's where the action is. The shopping, the restaurants, the infamous Woody's with its infamous happy hour. Happy hour? Cash almost interrupts Paulette to remind her who she has in her car, but his mother puts a hand on his arm to silence him. Winnie's head is out the window, and Cash decides to take the dog's lead and turn his gaze outward, tuning out Paulette. Baker can handle her. The town is maybe 4 blocks long. It's understated and laid back. There are restaurants with outdoor seating under awnings, bakeries, barbecue joints, shops selling silver jewelry, renting snorkel equipment. Nothing gaudy or overbearing. They pass public tennis courts and a school with children in yellow and navy uniforms out on the playground. The children are just back to school after the holiday break, Paulette says. I have a son at that school. He's 6.
I have a son who's 4, Baker says. He's back in Houston with his mother.
Cash supposes he should be grateful that Baker's an extrovert. He will be the goodwill ambassador, and Cash will tend to Irene. The family joke has always been that Cash is the daughter Irene never had. It doesn't bother Cash because he's secure in his masculinity. He knows his strengths. He's sensitive, thoughtful, introspective, a nurturer. And Baker is alpha, or he was until he married Anna. She definitely wears the pants in that family, hell, the whole tuxedo. But Cash is relieved to see that Baker has retained his charm. Out of town, the road grows steep and curvy. Paulette is pointing out trailheads, talking about hiking, about the 3,000-year-old petroglyphs of the Reef Bay Trail. Very famous, she says. They're what St. John is known for. On either side of the road is dense vegetation. Everything here is so green and alive, Cash can practically hear it growing. At the crest of a hill, Paulette pulls over to the shoulder. Below them is a crescent of white beach backed by palm trees. It's the most picture-perfect beach Cash has ever seen. It's so beautiful it hurts. That's Trunk Bay, Paulette says. Perennially voted one of the best beaches in the world.
Great, Baker says, nodding.
He pulls out his phone and Cash wonders if he's going to take a picture. But no, he's just checking the time.
Paulette, you are so kind to serve as our tour guide, and I hope you don't think I'm being rude when I suggest you take us right to my father's property. We've been traveling since early this morning.
Of course, Paulette says,
I just thought since you were unfamiliar with the island, you might want to see what all the fuss is about. They couldn't have sent anyone less sensitive, Cash thinks. And yet he doesn't want to alienate Paulette because she is, right now, their only link to Russ's life here. Paulette pulls back onto the road. She's at ease on the windy, twisty, and steep terrain, even though there's zero room for error. One side of the road is unforgiving mountain face, and the other side is a dramatic drop to the sea. Paulette waves to the drivers of the big, open-air taxis that pass them, too close for Cash's comfort, in the oncoming lane. Paulette stops to talk to one of the taxi drivers. They speak some kind of island patois. The only words Cash recognizes are invisible man. Is that what they call Russ? He wonders. He peers discreetly at his mother. Her eyes are closed. Finally, Paulette slows down, puts on her blinker, and turns. They drive up a series of hairpin turns. The road is deserted and it's shady. There are driveways, but no houses are visible. At the end of the road is a high gate with a sign that reads, "Private." Baker laughs. Is this where Kenny Chesney lives? Paulette punches a code into the keypad, and the gate swings open. Cash nudges his mother awake. He knows she's tired, but she has to see this. It's like something from a movie. This is his father's villa. His father's villa, on an island in the Caribbean. Cash can't help thinking that there has been a mistake, a very large, serious, and yet simple mistake. A man named Russell Steele did die in a helicopter crash north of Virgin Gorda, but it was a different Russell Steele. Their Russell Steele, husband, father, connoisseur of arcane trivia and corny puns, fan of the Beatles and the Blues Brothers, is still alive somewhere, schmoozing with clients in Sarasota or Pensacola or some other town with a Seminole name. The driveway is long, surrounded on both sides by evenly spaced palm trees, each of which has a spotlight at the bottom. When they reach the house, Cash takes his mother's hand. We're here, Paulette says. They all climb out of the car. Baker lets out a long, low whistle. He has absolutely no impulse control. The property is stunning. They're way, way up high with 180-degree views of the water and the islands beyond. Paulette leads them up a curved stone staircase to a mahogany deck where she turns with her arms open like a woman on a game show, as if to present the view. That's Joost van Dyck, and next to it, Tortola. What? Irene says.
The British Virgin Islands, Mom, Baker says.
Paulette guides them around the outside of the house. The grounds are impeccably landscaped with bougainvillea, frangipani, banana trees, and tall hibiscus bushes. There's a round aqua pool with a slide down to a second free-form dark blue pool below. A few yards away is a separate hot tub, water bubbling, surface steaming. There's a covered outdoor kitchen with a granite bar, a grill, an ice machine, and a glass-fronted refrigerator displaying a variety of Italian sparkling waters. Cash shakes his head. This isn't his father's house. Russ drinks tap water. Paulette opens a sliding glass door and they all step into the house. After the heat outside, the air conditioning is delicious. The ceiling of the living room is peaked, with thick beams jutting from the center like the spokes of a wheel. They wander into the enormous eat-in kitchen, and Paulette says, I'll let you explore in peace. I'll be on the deck if you have any questions. Which way to the master bedroom? Irene asks. And is there a study? The master is at the end of that hall, Paulette says. Mr. Steele's study is attached. All of the other bedrooms are upstairs, and there's a lower level with a billiards table and a wine cellar. That level opens up onto the shuffleboard court below, and the steps to the beach.
There are 80 steps, just so you're aware.
I'm going down to check that out,
Baker says. He looks at Cash.
Do you want to come?
I'll go with Mom, Cash says. He can't let his mother walk into the master bedroom, presumably where his father slept, by herself. Baker cocks an eyebrow, a signature expression of his, and Cash remembers just how much his brother irks him. Cash resents Baker's confidence, his smug self-assuredness, his aura of superiority. Baker is the worst kind of older brother. All alpha dominance, no support or advice. But the most frustrating thing is that despite this, Cash yearns to be just like him. This place is unbelievable, Baker says.
And I do mean unbelievable.
He lowers his voice. It can't be Dad's. They have the wrong guy. Cash doesn't comment, though he happens to agree. He trails his mother down the long hall to the master suite. In the bedroom is a king bed positioned to face the water through an enormous sliding glass door. There are two walk-in closets. Empty, both of them, Cash checks immediately. And there's a huge marble bathroom with dual sinks, a sunken soaking tub for two, and a glassed-in shower. There's a paneled study, which is where Irene has chosen to start poking around. The top of the desk is clear, so she's rifling through drawers. Cash, meanwhile, pokes through the bathroom. There are a couple of toothbrushes and a can of shaving cream, but nothing else in the way of personal items. The place feels staged. It feels cleaned out. If Russ had been living here or even just staying here, Irene said he'd left Iowa on December 26th, then wouldn't he have left behind clothes, a razor, aftershave, reading glasses? Cash opens the drawers of the dresser. Empty. That's weird, right? He goes over to the bed and opens the drawer of the nightstand. He startles as if he's found a disembodied head. There's a photograph staring up at him. It's a framed photograph of Russ with a West Indian woman. They're lying in a hammock. Cash turns around. It's the hammock that's hanging out on the deck right off the master bedroom. Russ is wearing sunglasses and grinning at the camera, and the woman is snuggled up against him. Cash casts about the room for a better place to hide the photograph. He can't have his mother seeing it. He stuffs it between the mattress and box spring, then sits on the bed and drops his head in his hands. His unspoken suspicions have been confirmed. Russ had a mistress, most likely the woman who was with him on the helicopter. The bigger shock, perhaps, is seeing a picture of his father in this house. This is real. This is his father's house. His father is dead. Cash wants to laugh. It's absurd. Cash wants to scream. After all of Russ's gentle prodding for Cash to finish his education and establish an infrastructure, it turns out his father's own infrastructure was built of lies. He had a secret life. A $15 million villa in the Caribbean and a West Indian mistress. What else? Cash wonders. What else was Russell Steele, a three-term member of the Iowa City School Board while Cash was growing up, hiding? He pokes his head into the study where his mother is sitting at the desk, staring out the window.
I'm going out to get some air, Mom, he says. I'll be right back.
Was there anything in the bedroom? She asks.
Not really, Cash says. This is like the house of a stranger.
Well, she says. He finds Paulette out on the front deck, reciting a shopping list to someone over the phone. When Paulette sees him, she hangs up and lights a cigarette. He's encouraged by this gesture. He needs to talk to the real Paulette Vickers.
So, what do you think of the house? She asks.
I have some questions.
His voice is low. He leans his forearms on the railing and she follows suit.
Together, they gaze out at the vista, the glittering aquamarine water, the lush green islands, the sleek boats that must belong to the luckiest people in the world. Maybe Paulette takes this landscape for granted, but for Cash, it's like discovering another planet. I'd like to talk frankly, without my mother present.
I'll answer what questions I can, Paulette says.
This is my father's house?
Yes.
Where are all of his things? His clothes, for example. His shoes, his bathing suits, his deodorant. It's as anonymous as a Holiday Inn.
Nicer than a Holiday Inn, Paulette says.
Please don't dodge the question, Cash says. If he was staying here before he left on that helicopter, where are his things? Did someone go through the house?
I did, Paulette says. I had strict orders from Mr. Croft's secretary to rid the house of all personal effects.
She pauses.
So as not to upset you. Or your mother.
So where are they? Cash asks.
Packed up, Paulette says. Mr. Croft sent someone to collect them this morning.
Did he? Cash says. Does Mr. Croft have a house on St. John as well?
Not to my knowledge, Paulette says.
What does that mean, not to your knowledge? Cash says. You're a local with a child in the schools. You work for a real estate agency. It seems like you would know whether or not Mr. Croft has a house here.
Down here, Paulette says, a lot of the high-end properties are owned by trusts. People come to the islands to escape, Mr. Steele.
To hide, Cash thinks. Can you tell me where Mr. Croft does live? Cash says. Where is his business located?
Again, I'm not certain.
Paulette, Cash says.
He feels himself about to snap out at the woman.
She seems nice, lovely even, so he can't understand why she's giving him the runaround. I'm sure you can see that we're grieving. My brother and I lost our father, my mother her husband. If he died of a heart attack at home, this would have been tragic enough. But he died here, in a place we didn't know he'd even visited, much less owned property in. The details we've received are sparse. Part of the way the three of us are going to process our loss is to find out exactly what happened. We need to talk to Todd Croft.
That would be a start, I suppose, Paulette says.
Do you have a phone number for him?
Paulette laughs dryly.
For Mr. Croft? No, I'm afraid not. I've never met the man. I've never even spoken to him on the phone.
You're kidding, Cash says. I deal with his secretary, Paulette says. Marilyn. She called your mother, so your mother has her number.
But it's Mr. Croft who pays you, Cash says. Right?
He nearly says, it's Mr. Croft who pulls the puppet strings.
He pulled Russ's, or at least that was how it had seemed.
I was paid by Mr. Steele directly, Paulette says, in cash, and occasionally by Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Thompson? Cash says.
Who is Mr. Thompson? Stephen Thompson, Paulette says. He was their associate.
Their associate, Cash says.
He feels like he's on a detective show, only he's the new guy, first day on the job, fecklessly trying to figure things out.
Do you have a number for Mr. Thompson, then?
I do, Paulette says. She stares at the glowing tip of her cigarette.
Paulette, again.
Mr. Thompson is dead, Paulette says. He was the pilot.
He was the pilot, Cash says. And the third person who died, the local woman, she and my father, were involved?
I'm not comfortable discussing that, Paulette says.
I have a photograph of them together, Cash says. It was in the drawer of the nightstand.
Paulette exhales a stream of smoke and casts her eyes down.
What's her name?
Again, Mr. Steele, I'm not—
Paulette, Cash says. Please. Please.
His voice breaks, and he fears he's going to cry.
He wants to go back to New Year's Eve, or even to New Year's Day, to the mortifying and yet inevitable conversation with Glenn the accountant. He wants his father to be alive. Cash will confess his failure with the stores, and he won't go to Breckenridge to waste away the rest of his young adulthood. He'll enroll at the University of Denver. He'll get a degree. He'll make something of himself. But he wants his father back. His desperation creates a sour taste in his mouth, and he inhales a breath, the honey scent of frangipani combined with Paulette's secondhand smoke. Paulette looks at Cash. She must sense his pain because her brown eyes well with tears. Rosie, she says, Rosie Small. She was the daughter of Leanne Powers, who was married to Captain Huck. Leanne died 5 years ago. Paulette taps her ashes into the bougainvillea below. There's going to be a memorial service tomorrow at the Episcopalian Church, with a reception following at Chester's getaway. If you go to either the service or the reception, you'll find people who can tell you more. But I'd advise you to be discreet, and to go with an open mind and an open heart. Lots and lots of people on this island loved Rosie Small, and almost no one on this island knew your father. Like I said, he preferred to remain invisible. Cash turns around to face the house. And we can stay here a few days?
As long as you want, Paulette says. It's yours now.
Okay, thank you, Paulette, Cash says. Really, thank you.
God bless you boys, Paulette says. And God bless your mother.